Hello, and a very warm welcome to the Studio Canal Presents podcast. My name is Simon Brew from Film Stories magazine, and this is a regular podcast celebrating one of the biggest and deepest film libraries in the world. Studio Canal's extensive catalogue of films brings together cinema from around the globe, going back over a century. The full library is over 6,000 titles strong, including the flat-out action of Universal Soldier and Cliffhanger, international delights such as Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown and Ran, and acclaimed modern favourites The Place Beyond the Pines and Summer's Town. And we're going to do our very best to explore it all in this podcast. This time, well, proceed with caution. We're exploring one of cinema's most popular, most blood-soaked, most crunchy horror franchises, Evil Dead. And I'm going to be talking to the man who's written and directed the latest, Evil Dead Rise, that's in UK cinemas now. That man is Lee Cronin, and here's a taster of what he's served up. I'll be talking to him the other side of this clip.
When I was just a little girl, I asked my mother,
"What is this, Danny?"
"I found it."
"What will I be?"
"Kanda."
"Will I be pretty?"
"Estrada."
"Will I be rich?"
"Inactive."
Here's what she said to me.
A very warm welcome to Lee Cronin. Hello, Lee. How are you?
Hey, Simon. I'm doing good. Thank you. Thanks for having me aboard.
Well, thank you for making an Evil Dead film, I should say that. Before we get into the conversation, though, we do like to ask of our guests just a little film fact of them. The first film you saw, just a little bit of film trivia. Have you got something for us, Lee?
I do. It's not the first thing I saw, but because I make horror movies, I think it's worth me mentioning the first time I remember being scared by a piece of filmed entertainment.
Okay.
Which was when I saw Jaws for the first time when I was about 6 or 7 years old. And it was specifically the scene with Ben Gardner's head popping out of the boat hole. It was the first time I remember basically experiencing a jump scare in any way, shape or form and being terrified by that. And since that day, Jaws has remained my favorite movie of all time. And then in addition, not only that, I very luckily, many, many years later, through a very random encounter, managed to meet Mr. Spielberg and tell him what I've just told
you. Incredible.
Which is that Ben Gardner's head scared the crap out of me when I was 6 years old and set me on a course to wanting to make horror movies.
Where are you on Jaws 3D, though? That's clearly the masterpiece.
Do you know what? I'm not sure I've ever watched. I'm sure I have.
Oh, what a treat you've got.
I'm sure I know. Do you know, I have, but not since, you know, I was like 12 years old. It's one of those ones I've seen. I've definitely seen number 4 more times than I'd like to admit. But yeah, I'm a pure, as weird as, you know, I've just directed the 5th entry in a franchise, I'm kind of actually a bit of a purist when it comes to movies like that. So Jaws is the one and done for me.
Okay, well, fair enough. We'll let you off with that. Look, I mean, let's move to Evil Dead and start with a logical question, really. I mean, Jaws came into your life at 6, 7 years old. When did Evil Dead?
Pre being 10, put it that way. I was not 6 or 7, but I was no older than 9.
Okay.
And in my home, everybody was pretty much a horror fan. I have 3 siblings, my mum and dad. My mum less so, but my dad was into horror movies. And like I saw The Shining, I'd seen Poltergeist, I'd seen Nightmare on Elm Street. And my dad had rented Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2 on VHS, and we watched them back to back. When I was about 9 years old, and I was obviously smart enough to look away if I was scared, but those movies, as frightening as they are, they're so appealing to the eye in their energy and the kind of the visceral madness that takes place. I'd no idea what I was watching.
Yeah.
You know, I'd no idea what it was, and I'd no idea what it would do to my life, actually, at that point in time, and continue to send me down the pathway towards the things that I do now as a filmmaker. So it was yet very, very early introduction. And then I feel like specifically Evil Dead 2 was something then that I caught on TV, pieces of this movie, in the few years after. But it wasn't maybe till my early teen years that I realized the importance of these movies and their place in the culture. I remember my sister was a big fan of Army of Darkness and brought that movie to me on a couple of occasions as well when it came out.
Yeah.
And then I really started to understand where these movies fitted into, you know, horror and cinematic history. And they always just felt like great places to go back to when you needed to watch something scary and entertaining.
Hey!
There's a tape recorder here.
See what's on it.
As you just mentioned there, they clearly have a very strong place in the history of horror cinema. Can you explain a little bit more of that for us, certainly from your perspective as someone who's now made an Evil Dead film?
Yeah, I think the independent spirit that drove the first movie and then on into the second movie.
Yeah.
Sam Raimi, Rob Tappert and Bruce Campbell understand and would admit this too. The haphazardness of the franchise in a way, like it's almost lack of connectivity in certain respects. You know, the fact that Evil Dead 2 is kind of a remake and kind of recaps the first movie in a way.
Yeah.
And the fact that there's these two different endings to Army of Darkness, all these things, it actually adds to the charm of the movies. And I think apart from the visuality and the sheer kind of film craft on show, I think there is something to the shonkiness of how it all came together and how it all held together that makes them, like, despite the darkness, like, extremely friendly. I always feel those movies felt like my friends when they were sitting on my shelf of physical media. And I think that differentiates them slightly. They also have only ever really made movies when it felt really worthy, and I'm hoping I've managed to continue the trend with Evil Dead Rise, that there's not a weak baby inside the franchise right now.
Presumably you felt the pressure of that. I mean, talking about the person of as a 9-year-old watching this for the first time, which obviously we don't endorse because I'll get fired from this job.
I can endorse it. I fully endorse it.
You can.
In the UK, it's different because the movie's an 18s, but in the US, for example, where this film is an R-rated, bring your children. Absolutely. Bring your children, bring the neighbours, bring everybody. Bring their blankies and bring their plushies and they'll have a great time.
Legend has it that it was written by the Dark Ones. Necronomicon Ex Mortis. Roughly translated, Book of the Dead.
You talked then about Evil Dead 2 was the one where it really kind of sparked for you.
Yeah.
And arguably really sparked the franchise as we know it today.
Yeah.
What is so special about that film?
It's the sheer relentlessness of it, which I adore.
Yeah.
And the fact that it's almost tongue-in-cheek that they do open with this recap that's so energetic. The movie never starts because it's like it's already started. You know what I mean? It's like you're just immediately in it.
Yeah.
The book served as a passageway to the evil worlds beyond. It was written long ago when the seas ran red with blood.
The level of creativity, I've used the word film craft already. Like, Sam Raimi is a filmmaker that I admire enormously, and alongside some other filmmakers is kind of on my Mount Rushmore as such of craftspeople that I look up to. I feel like with Evil Dead 2, would have been what, his third movie? I feel like that's when he really found his confidence and found his feet.
Yeah.
The original is fantastic in its own way, but it's rough around the edges. There's almost a student-y quality at times to it. I don't think it takes away from that movie at all. But with Evil Dead 2, you really start feeling a filmmaker like in control. And that's what I quite like about that movie, is you have to submit and have your hand held. And I want to make movies where people kind of have to submit. Once they cross the line, they pay their fare and they enter the dark room.
Yeah.
They've got to go with whatever comes next. And that's how I feel about Evil Dead 2. And also, I think it plays some beautiful chords beyond the obvious things that people think about, like, oh, the blood and the silliness and the gags. Like, the psychological trauma that character is going through.
Yeah.
Probably one of my highlight moments across the entire franchise is when Ash is losing it and all these inanimate objects are laughing at him, and then he joins laughing alongside them and moving up and down almost like in this routine with them. That was something that would always stick out in my head as being quite unique in a horror context.
I didn't appreciate until fairly recently Stephen King's hand in the success of the series as well, the history of how Evil Dead 2 was originally going to be Army of Darkness,
mm-hmm.
of the assault of different financiers coming through, and it took a Stephen King phone call or review or something really to kickstart it. Were you conscious of all of that backstory?
Yeah, like I would have had an awareness because I knew the history of the movies and I'd read about the history of the movies also, but then obviously working in close quarters with the guys, you get some really interesting stories and memories being raised about the journey that they went on to make these films. I know Stephen King obviously gave them a quote originally that they were able to plaster on their promotional materials, and it was like the ultimate seal of approval. More so in a time when all you needed was the one right voice to say one thing rather than all the noise we face now.
Yeah.
Like if Stephen King says something nice about this movie, with Evil Dead Rise, I'd be really flattered and it'll help us, but it'll be one voice amongst so many. But as an authority at the time, I think his support for the movie helped massively. I also think what gets overlooked sometimes is that neither the original or Evil Dead 2 were really theatrical movies in a lot of ways. Of course, they got cinema play, but the guys just wanted to make a movie that they thought could play at drive-ins. You know, that was their plan. They analysed and thought, this is a smart thing to do. Like, they're comedy fans.
Yeah.
I know, having spoken to Sam, he wasn't instinctively like, I want to make horror movies.
Yeah.
That wasn't necessarily where they wanted to go, but they saw an opportunity to try and plant a flag and get on the map and build a career somehow. It's like that old thing of, like, you can have a bad horror movie but with a good poster and people will still go and see it. I'd rather have a great horror movie with a great poster, or even a great horror movie with a bad poster. But the guys set about it with the vigor of wanting to make something that people would pay attention to. And I think that is part of the success, because they didn't really leave anything on the pitch, right? They went for it. Especially with Evil Dead 2, it's like everything is there. Everything is there to see.
Even now we have your darling Linda soul.
You're going down. Chainsaw.
I think the guys would have gone on to still have the careers that they had because the talent was there and the drive and ambition was there.
Yeah.
But I think Evil Dead 2 set a course for the franchise in a way. And what I find really interesting is speaking to people who, like me, this movie was influential on.
Yeah.
I love the scene in High Fidelity where they talk about, have you not seen Evil Dead 2 yet?
Yeah.
Even recently, I was flying from Los Angeles to Austin to do our world premiere at South by Southwest. And sitting across me on the plane was an actor called Glenn Howerton from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
He plays Dennis, and I'm a massive fan of that show. So I couldn't resist saying hello. And he was asking me why I was going to South By, and he was going to South By with a movie. And I was like, oh, I'm a new Evil Dead movie. He goes, oh my God, like, Evil Dead 2 is the reason I wanted to get into entertainment. So I think that movie also landed with a generation at a certain time with a certain quality that inspired a lot of people. And I think part of its longevity has been that inspiration. And also, that inspiration wasn't by accident. It comes from the verve that's in that movie, and it comes from the guts that both spill, but the guts to make a movie that way,
yeah.
I think shows people that anything's possible, and I think it drives a certain spirit and ambition when you watch it.
You've dropped into conversation a couple of times here, the guys. And the guys, of course, being Sam Raimi, being Bruce Campbell, and being Rob Tappert as well. And you mentioned that they were telling you some of the stories,
yeah,
that you hadn't heard before, presumably, of trying to get these made.
Yeah.
Is there just one of them you can give a taster of?
Do you know what it actually is? One of the really interesting things, it's not specifically a story, it's the understanding of how things work.
Yeah.
Was how long it took them to shoot all those movies. These are not movies you can make quickly. And one thing that stands out in my head, obviously the first one they returned and they went back and they shot more. And, you know, I was making my film at a different time through like a studio structure where there are different kind of limitations in terms of time and money and schedule and all of these things.
Yeah.
But I think Army of Darkness was over 100 days to shoot that movie. And to give that some context, say Jurassic World, the first of the new Jurassic movies from a few years ago,
yeah,
I think the schedule in that movie was probably something like 82 days.
Yeah.
So Army of Darkness took longer to shoot than a Jurassic movie, which shows a lot about, again, the practicality of what they were doing and how that would work. And the pressure, like those guys being kind of stuck in that space,
yeah,
that world they were in making that movie for such a long period of time. But you know what? We weren't a million miles behind with Evil Dead Rise because we shot for 63 days and I also ran a second unit for 30 days. So we were rolling camera for 93 days on that movie.
Couldn't you have gone another 7 and then you're in the 100 club?
I know. Unfortunately, the meter always turns off at some point and the lights go out, and that was that point in time.
I was talking to a film producer a couple of weeks ago and they would just say how rare the 100 club is now.
Yeah.
That,
yeah,
technology has just taken that down so much and knocked like 20 days off a shoot that used to be 60.
Yeah, and I guess that's part of it. And also, like, everything in the world beyond filmmaking, everything gets squeezed nowadays, right? You don't always, yeah, necessarily get the time.
Yeah.
You certainly don't get the time to discover things on set. You've got to be prepped in a way that you absolutely know what you're trying to achieve up front.
Specific to Evil Dead Rise, you could control that set, though. You had, this was soundstage primarily. And I would imagine the prep on it was quite exhausting to get everything, yeah, in place you needed.
Yeah, the prep was very intense, and the prep needed for a movie like this to be absolutely as long as the shoot. So,
yeah,
like, all in initially was basically from the moment I flew to New Zealand and I went into managed isolation for 2 weeks before I was allowed out into their COVID-free world at the time, because we shot the movie at the height of COVID.
Yeah.
And I got out of managed isolation on a Sunday, and I started prep on the Monday. And at that point, it was a 12-week prep, so 3 months of preparation, followed by a 12-week shoot. But with 8 days to go, we actually, COVID got into New Zealand and we were shut down for 2 months. So I had to stay locked in an apartment for 2 months to go back and finish the movie. But the prep part was extremely thorough and had to be, because,
yeah,
like, one of the interesting things about making a movie like this, first of all, is we shot it as much as we could in a linear fashion, because we destroyed our sets as we went.
Yeah.
And you couldn't go back. Of course you could go back, but the cleanup and the cost and the rebuilds and all these things. So we had to go in a linear fashion, and therefore the movie gets increasingly intense. So every day got harder. There was never, oh, but it's cool because we've got that week coming up where we do this. No, no, because the movie just keeps on building. So as you get more tired and the set falls apart more, the things you're trying to achieve get even harder again. So that was quite a unique experience. I think of those, say, 63 main unit days that I shot on the movie, we were only outdoors for 3 or 4.
Yeah.
So I was definitely a pasty boy by the end of making this movie and hadn't seen the sunlight in a long time.
Is that right?
What's up, sis?
I had the most beautiful dream.
It was the perfect day. And all I could think about was how much I wanted to cut you all open and then climb inside your bodies so that we could stay one happy family.
I mean, you talk about the physicality of making Evil Dead Rise there and just, like, having to reset the set. I don't think I'm going massively spoilery to suggest that at one stage there is a reasonable amount of blood.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're saying brings to mind something like James Cameron making Titanic. If he floods a set and gets a shot wrong, it takes, like, half the day just to reset that one.
Yeah.
Day. Was that the kind of level of thing you were up against?
In certain contexts, yes. There was a number of set pieces in the movie where the way I scheduled them with my first assistant director, who had travelled from Ireland with me. It was me and him from Ireland, and then we were with this incredible crew in New Zealand.
Yeah.
There was a couple of things where we would schedule it in the morning, and if it didn't go right, we'd go off and shoot other things while the cleanup happened, and we'd have one chance to shoot it at the end of the day again. We never, luckily, ever had to pull that card.
Yeah.
Because we prepped right. Those big events were prepped to within an inch of their lives, and the control of the soundstage and the sets is really important because the movie is so contained but so interactive.
Yeah.
That I needed to be able to actually pull those sets apart and be highly creative with all of the angles and all the things that we could do. Because if I was shooting it on location, first of all, you couldn't ruin the place like we had to, but you'd also run out of shooting angles very quickly because you just find yourself increasingly backing into corners with nowhere else to go.
Hey, I'll swallow your soul. I'll swallow your soul. I'll swallow your soul.
Swallow this.
Can I ask you, from a filmmaker's perspective, just bringing Evil Dead 2 to Evil Dead Rise a little bit, we've talked about the ingenuity of the way Sam Raimi shot that film.
Mm-hmm.
And it always struck me as ingenuity out of necessity. He was up against such boundaries to make it and coming up with such intense and different ways to shoot it.
Mm-hmm.
Could you relate to that a little when you go into the Evil Dead world? Because you had slightly more tools than he had,
yeah,
but you seem to be trying to keep that ethos.
Yeah, I think there's a certain part of it which is I wanted to maintain, I don't know what the right word for it is, but I wanted to maintain an independent spirit to it. So although the film, yeah, is extremely well refined and quite glossy and engineered in a lot of ways, I wanted it to have that edge. And I guess I come from the independent space, so maybe that was just, yeah, naturally part of what I would do. But despite the resources that we had, my imagination was still bigger than the budget. So we did have to be smart in the ways that we did things. And it's not too spoilery, but, you know, in the trailer, people will get a sense of blood exiting an elevator. And there's a bigger sequence built around that. But that was something that was on the chopping block all the time because it was so complicated and so expensive. And I had to use all of my will and intent to find a way to utilize less resources than I would have to create the scene that I wanted. Everybody wanted it. The producers wanted it. Sam, Rob, Bruce wanted these things. But how do we make it work? And then that's when you as a filmmaker have to lean into your toolbox and your ingenuity to find a way to deliver exactly what you want, but maybe not in the obvious way that you can just throw all the money in the world at.
Yeah.
And maybe that comes through in the movie as well. Maybe that's why you're noting it, because,
yeah,
it wasn't Easy Street.
It didn't look Easy Street whatsoever. I just thought, I'm glad you had to make it and not me. I certainly think that. Because I didn't have parents who were willing to go to the video shop for me and show me films underage, the first time I became aware, really, of the Evil Dead saga was Army of Darkness.
Mm-hmm.
And in hindsight, I mean, looking back at the history of the franchise, that was the first Evil Dead film, I think, that came with a weight of expectation on it.
Yeah.
My name is Ash, and I am a slave.
The others almost felt shot out of a cannon from nowhere.
Yeah.
Close as I can figure it, the year is 1300 AD, and I'm being dragged to my death.
But there was anticipation for Army of Darkness. You just mentioned it a little while back. What was your take on Army of Darkness? Were you someone who was sat there just like counting down the days?
No, I was kind of too young in a way. Like, I'm trying to remember what year Army of Darkness was. Army of Darkness, 93?
92, I believe.
92, yeah, I should get all my Evil Dead facts right, but I was basically 10 or 11 years old at that point. So I probably missed it upon release, if you know what I mean, and caught up with it later on, certainly after it was available to rent and watch at home. I do remember when I heard of it, though, at the time, and I loved the title. I always loved Sam's idea of wanting to call it The Medieval Dead. I wish it had absolutely been called that.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting one because what I also love about the franchise itself is that people have favourites.
Yeah.
Some people love Army of Darkness, some people love Evil Dead 2. Some people who like it really dark want to go back and just watch The Evil Dead.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'd like to be able to go back in a little time machine maybe and gone to the cinema to see it. In fact, I only actually got to see Evil Dead 2 in the cinema for the first time about 9 months ago, 9-10 months ago.
Interesting.
Yeah, and luckily Bruce Campbell was in Dublin. Right now where we're recording this podcast.
That's a sentence.
Yeah, I know. So it's actually funny synergy right now because right now I'm sitting in the bowels of a cinema in Dublin called the Lighthouse Cinema.
Yeah.
Which is where we're doing the European premiere of Evil Dead Rise tonight. And it was actually in this very cinema. They happened to be showing Evil Dead 2 in a special Sam Raimi retrospective when Bruce Campbell was in Dublin to engage on some of the sound design sessions I was doing towards the end of the movie. And I said, hey, Bruce, guess what? They're showing Evil Dead 2. And I was like, why don't you just come along and surprise everybody? Like, we won't announce it at all.
No.
So we did that. So I got brought out. It's like, we've got the director of Evil Dead Rise, you know, and everybody was like, okay, that's interesting. And then I was like, oh, by the way, I've got a special guest. And we brought Bruce in and everybody lost their shit. But it was the funnest part of that night was we were waiting to go into the screen. Everyone had gone in.
Yeah.
And we were waiting to go in and we'd kind of shuffled in as to not be spotted. And one wonderful proper nerd, like my kind of nerd, like fully bearded, you know, young guy in the Evil Dead 2 t-shirt had come back out of the cinema to go to the bathroom, I guess, and walked by Bruce and looked at him and kept going and then stopped and looked at him again. And this happened about 6 times before it actually connected in his head that he was looking at Bruce Campbell. And then he just panicked, didn't go to the bathroom and ran back into the cinema for fear of missing Bruce's moment.
Oh, that's incredible.
Yeah, I don't know where this question started, but there's a story.
I don't know. I'm just thinking as well, given that it's your sister who kept getting you videos as well, I hope you're inviting her to your premiere.
She's here tonight and
she'll be
coming tonight and she's very excited, along with a bunch of my family and nieces and nephews and friends. And it's the most anxiety-inducing screening you can have when there's people you know and care about there versus a room full of strangers.
Yeah.
And especially for all the support that I've kind of got along the way. Tonight is going to be quite a special occasion.
There is, of course, the Bruce Campbell factor as well, that we've got Campbell as the executive producer and you've hidden him in the film, although I think someone's found it, but you offered a cash prize.
I did.
For the person who found it. So there's only one question really, Lee Cronin. You're a major international filmmaker now. What level of cash do you give to the someone who finds Bruce Campbell hidden in your film?
It was a $50 reward,
really?
Which I thought was a nice round number.
That's nice.
Yeah, $50 reward. And I feel quite bad, actually, because as it stands, I haven't announced the winner yet because I've been so busy. And the person in question, a few people had a stab before the film screened at South by Southwest. But the person in question came racing up to me as I was leaving the stage after the Q&A and got it word for word, bang on, knew exactly what the moment with Bruce was. And I've had people reach out since, have seen it at secret screenings and also get it right. But unfortunately, in this case, there's no prizes for runners-up. So I do need to announce that person and send them their crisp $50 bill.
I was going to say, have you not paid up?
Not paid up yet. I'm investing that $50 for now and seeing if I can turn it into $52 so I can make a profit.
Put it into cryptocurrency. It'll be fine. They won't mind.
Oh, perfect. Perfect. An Evil Dead coin.
Perfect. Lee Cronin, I've got to ask you this. Tell me about your amazing opening titles. I am a lover of opening titles, and I think you are too.
Yes, I am indeed. it's interesting. I'm very detail oriented.
Yeah.
And obviously the first thing I wrote for this screenplay, which isn't always the way, sometimes you might write a scene to get you started in the middle of something, but I wrote the opening of the movie, and it's very, very close to what I put on the page. So even the scale of how the title appears on screen is presented on paper that way, because I always like people, when they read, to get the impression of the full experience of the movie.
Yeah.
And there was just, I wanted essentially to open the movie in a way to give you a taste of the experience, and then also to have this quite gutsy, operatic, almost like showing off, going, this is going to be a big deal.
Yeah.
So I wanted to have these grinding letters like rising up through the sky and dominating this already quite stark, beautiful but horrific image. And it's really nice of you to note it, because I can only really reflect on recent experiences right now, and the one major public screening I've attended at South by Southwest, people were screaming and whooping and hollering as that title, because I think what you experience in the build-up to it, it's a payoff, right?
Yeah.
And it's telling you to prepare for what comes next.
I think it very well prepares for what's going to follow in the 90 minutes thereafter.
Yeah.
I think I can safely say that.
Good to hear. Good to hear.
I'm getting us out of here. I promise.
You'd be a good mom someday, honey.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. You know how to lie to kids.
We come to the bit of the podcast where we ask our guests to dig into the Studio Canal catalogue and to pick out a few favourites. And you've come up with some really quite wonderful choices for it. One that took my eye very early, no one really brings this up an awful lot, is Eden Lake.
Yeah.
A British horror film. It's Kelly Reilly, isn't it? Who's currently starring in Yellowstone.
Yeah, Kelly Reilly and Michael Fassbender and Jack O'Connor.
Yeah, absolutely.
Fantastic cast in an extremely dark and grim movie. Like, Eden Lake, I saw it in the cinema, from memory. I'm pretty sure I did.
Yeah, so did I.
And I was blown away by this great film craft. Again, it's a word I use a lot.
Yeah.
In a sense, it's straightforward. It's a couple go to the forest, they encounter bad people. We've seen it before. But there's obviously an undercurrent of social commentary that works extremely well in the film.
Yeah.
And plays out really well. And then there's kind of just a sheer brutality to it that I hadn't kind of seen in quite some time.
Please let me go. I won't say anything. Please let me go. Listen, Brett. People know that we're here. They're gonna call the police. If you let me go, I swear on my life, I won't tell anyone. Look, guys, come on, please, we can stop this. Nobody's died yet.
Like, a very, very different film tonally, but that was on your list, and I nearly added was, speaking of lists, was Kill List.
Right.
Which is probably the next British film in the horror context that also just hit you in that really, really primal way, like that really uncomfortable way. And Eden Lake was one of those movies I was so happy to buy it as soon as it came out. And then, like, you know, people come to my apartment and go, watch this with me, and watch them really suffer. It's an excellent film with a devastating ending as well.
Well, I wasn't going to spoilery particularly, but I would say that both Kill List and Eden Lake are films that, to my eyes, have never seen a test audience. There's not a whiff of compromise about where those films go.
That's actually a really interesting way of looking at it, yeah, because there's a sheer bloody-mindedness to what they want to achieve.
Yeah.
And I think that's a great thing in filmmaking, full stop. You know, even reflecting on my experiences with Evil Dead and the process of making a movie with, you know, big old school producers in a studio, people recognize sometimes that you need to actually not lay your hands on too heavily, because the purity of a vision is actually what makes something work. And I think that's why Eden Lake stands out for me as a film. And then there's some particular moments in that movie as well that are just, I'm trying to remember, I looked it up this morning and I've forgotten already the name of the actual technique of putting a rubber tire around someone's body to trap their arms and to then set them. And like, there is an actual name. It's called like a collaring. That's it.
Okay.
And the way that film is so in your face at times and happy to be in your face.
Yeah.
But they just pan away from the brutality of that moment. And that makes it even worse. So it's very, very smart filmmaking, really strong performances. And also non-traditional. There's quite a bit of movement around. It's not like they go to one place and get trapped there, they pop back into it's just a really interesting formula for that type of film.
Sticking with horror and celebrating its 50th birthday this year, incredibly, is The Wicker Man.
Yeah,
I mean, lots written about Wicker Man, but why is it such a personal choice to you?
What's interesting about The Wicker Man for me is that it's a movie that obviously was around before I was born, but that I didn't see until my 20s. Despite my horror education and all the things I'd seen in watching horror movies with my family, historically, I'd never seen The Wicker Man, and not only had I never seen it, I knew nothing about it other than that key artwork of Christopher Lee with his arms spread out
yeah.
in front of The Wicker Man. So I got to discover that at a time when I was already becoming a movie maker, you know what I mean? Already had gone through film school.
Right.
So it felt like it was just for me, even though it was old, which was an amazing experience. And what I love about the movie, kind of more than anything, and it's, I'd love to find a story to tell in these terms, and it's so hard, is one character surrounded by lots of other people that are constantly lying. Like, it's the purest form of conflict. And it's a musical, which I adore. I adore the music in the film. And it has just a truly dreadful, dreadful outro with the combination of somebody's painful demise set against the joy of the collective. It's like, even thinking about it now, it always makes me feel uncomfortable. Like the line, "There will be no traces." It's like no one wants to think that that's their exit point from the world.
And now, for our more dreadful sacrifice.
It's amazing how that seeped into public consciousness as well. I'm not a massive reality TV show fan, but I watched The Traitors last Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And The Traitors, I found a fascinating show, but they model, like, basically a task and an entire episode around The Wicker Man.
It's incredible.
Without contextualizing it at all.
That's incredible. And you think something that was essentially a low-budget, independent movie, taking risks, having this folksy, crazy musical score, and somehow it has sustained and it has lasted. And I think it's the purity of concept that does that for me.
Yeah.
There is a purity to the concept in the story. Everybody at some point in their existence will find themselves in a room where they're the one on the outside of the real information. And I think there's something primal in that that connects with people.
It could use some bees and Nicolas Cage, though, couldn't it?
Do you know, I've never, being a purist, I've not watched that particular remake.
What a treat you've missed out on.
Maybe I'll do it. Maybe I should do it.
Do that next, yeah. And then finally, you've gone for a bit of Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Yeah.
That's a nice contrast on your choice.
There needs to be something lighter. And you know, in looking at it and thinking about it, I actually rewatched it last night because I was definitely not in the mood for watching Eden Lake. So I rewatched it, and what I really realised in rewatching it yesterday was why Keanu Reeves has had such a great career.
Yeah.
He's truly excellent in the movie. Like, he has great timing. And although he's playing the doofus and kind of carried edges of that doofusness, if that's a word, into some elements of his career, early career, he's actually truly excellent in the movie, as is Alex Winter.
Yeah.
I'm Bill S. Preston, Esquire.
And I'm Ted.
Bill, here, you take it.
Okay.
And I'm Ted Theodore Logan.
Yeah!
And we're Wild Stallions!
It's kind of like a sketch show.
Yeah, very much.
There's not a lot in terms of plot. It's quite flimsy in plot terms, but that's why it's enjoyable. Like, Napoleon basically just has his own movie going on in the background at the same time, and it's so incredibly enjoyable. And I think that kind of, like, verve that it has, and weirdly, I'd never quite realised before, maybe it's an obvious thing that people did, it probably wouldn't have existed without something like Back to the Future. And,
yeah,
you know, I've talked about dark movies to date, but that entire world, like, ultimately, despite horror, I'm also, like, an Amblin kid. Like, I'm a child of Spielberg in many, many ways.
Yeah.
So I adore movies from, like, Batteries Not Included.
That's a dark film as well.
Yeah, that has some dark moments as well. The Goonies, which also has some dark moments.
Yeah.
And I think people sometimes ask me about my own work in terms of kids and threat, and I think that's where a little bit of it comes from, is watching those type of movies.
Yeah.
But what I love about Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure more than anything is just there's a great sense of optimism in the movie. And it's actually this particular West Coast Californian optimism that, like, leaks down through it. And when they're doing their presentation at the end of the movie, and it's cutting to some of the audience reacting, like, the, you know, the gather.
Yeah.
It's actually really cringy, but at the same time, it's really innocent.
Yeah.
It's a really rewatchable movie as well, and it's a brisk, I think it's like 90, 92 minutes long.
Yeah.
I'm actually really glad in getting to chat about these movies that it made me revisit it, because I hadn't seen it in quite some time.
Well, it sounds like there's an indirect influence on The Hole in the Ground there. 90, 92 minutes, kids under threat.
There you go.
Perfect.
There's a direct line. There's a hot take between Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure and The Hole in the Ground.
I think so. That's my clickbait. I'm done. Lee Cronin, thank you so much for joining us on Studio Canal Presents.
My absolute pleasure. Thanks, Simon.
You'll find Evil Dead 2, Army of Darkness, and 2013's Evil Dead on the Studio Canal Presents channel on Apple TV and Prime Video, and now also too on ITVX. Evil Dead Rise, meanwhile, is now playing in UK cinemas. We've just got time for some news of what's been happening in the world of Studio Canal. On the big screen then, a little update on a film I think one or two of you might just be interested in. That'd be Paddington 3, which is going by the name of Paddington in Peru, and it's now been confirmed that filming will begin this July. Filming has begun too on a new film, Cold Storage, starring Joe Keery, Liam Neeson, Georgina Campbell and Sosie Bacon. The upcoming thriller is now shooting in Italy and Morocco. David Koepp of Jurassic Park fame has written the script. Johnny Campbell directs the film. And then there's Past Lives, which I can now confirm will be arriving in UK cinemas on September the 8th. From writer-director Celine Song, this is a romantic drama about two childhood friends growing up in South Korea who meet 20 years after their lives were taken in different directions. Greta Lee and Teo Yu take the leads. Finally, a film we'll be talking about in a future episode of Studio Canal Presents, The Wicker Man, is 50 years old. And boy, it's set for a scorching birthday celebration. One date for your diary: a UK cinema release of the film's 4K restoration arrives on the summer solstice, June the 21st. Then the film will be on 4K disc 2 later in the year, with all three cuts of it restored. And that's it for this episode of Studio Canal Presents. We'll be back next month for another dive into the Studio Canal catalogue as we make an appointment with the work of David Lynch. In the meantime, to find out more about Studio Canal films and the Apple TV and Prime Video channel, as well as now on ITVX, you can visit www.studiocanal.co.uk or follow Studio Canal at Studio Canal UK on Twitter, Instagram and TikTok. And if you'd like to catch up on our previous episodes on everything from Terminator 2 and The Driver through to The Man Who Fell to Earth and Apocalypse Now, you can find them all wherever you get your podcasts. Now though, I'm off to board up my windows, look suspiciously at trees, and be wary of any creepy-looking books I might see. Enjoy Evil Dead Rise. I'll be back soon. Ta-ta for now.